WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Sports changed for women in 1972 with the passage of an amendment to the Civil Rights Bill known as Title IX. That amendment outlawed discrimination based on sex in schools receiving federal money. So girls and women's sports programs in schools and colleges expanded. One of the young women who joined a college team in the early 70s was my guest Mariah Burton Nelson. She played center on the women's basketball team at Stanford and went on to play professionally. She's now a sports writer and has written a book about women athletes called Are We Winning Yet? Through the athletes she profiles, Nelson examines the state of women's sports in America. I asked her about playing college ball during a transitional period for women.
Well, my first 2 years at Stanford, we wore little red shorts and white blouses with red pennies over them.
What's a penny?
A penny is a cloth sort of vest that girls used to wear instead of going shirts and skins to differentiate one team from the other. In other words, we didn't have uniforms. We played in the small, what was called the women's gym. It was the old men's gym, and the men played in the new 8,000-seat arena called Maples Pavilion. We didn't travel very much. We had a coach who was just a part-time graduate student who was volunteering her time. My second 2 years at Stanford, we finally got two full-time, very qualified coaches. We began to play in what had been called the men's gym. We began to travel more, and finally we got real uniforms. So I was sort of on that cusp between old-time women's sports and this new wave of new opportunity for women.
I think one of the things that changed in that new wave was that there were more male coaches for women's basketball.
Yes, I began to see that influx of male coaches, and I began to see some of the women adopt a male sort of style of coaching where they would yell at players until the players were in tears, using humiliation or threats as a way to motivate. I saw players, myself included, play through injury, not only through pain, but through injury, often making injuries worse in pursuit of victory. So while at the same time that we got a lot more opportunity, we started to suffer from some of the problems of men's sports as well.
What kind of attitude did you get from your fellow college students, male and female, when you were playing basketball?
Well, it was not a prestigious thing to do at Stanford. We had very small crowds. I think I was typecast as a jock. I was probably assumed to be a lesbian, which in my case was true, but that's something that is used to keep all women out of sport and to discourage women from going into sports. So even though I loved it, I had a terrific time. I enjoyed the process of learning about my body. I became strong. I loved the women I played with. It was a good opportunity, but it wasn't about fans and fame.
After college, you played with what you've described as the misguided and short-lived Women's Pro Basketball League. How was it misguided?
Well, it was run entirely by men. There were all male owners and coaches, and they didn't understand women. One man specifically told me, "This is not a women's lib thing." When one of my teammates had asked to be called women rather than girls. We were young women in our early 20s, right out of college, and it was the height, or one of the heights, of the feminist movement, and it was important to us as young women to be called women instead of girls, and he denied that request. We were sent to charm school on one team I played for as a way to deter people from calling us lesbians, basically, since that is a label that has always chased women athletes around the playing fields, as if to put on makeup or to learn how to dress in a traditional feminine manner proves that you're not gay. So I was insulted by a lot of those sort of things. There was another team that had mandatory makeup sessions before each home game.
What was the logic behind that?
Well, again, to sort of prove our femininity, as if playing basketball wasn't a feminine thing to do.
When you were playing pro basketball, were there big crowds for that?
Not in the United States. I did play in Europe for a year, and we drew crowds of up to 3,000 to 5,000. So for that time, late 70s, early 80s, that was considered pretty big. But by today's standards, no, they weren't big crowds either.
Is there more interest now in watching women's sports than there was when you were playing?
Well, there is. There's a lot more interest. Still, there isn't a successful women's pro league of basketball here in this country, but the tennis circuit, of course, draws big crowds. And the same excuse that's used to keep women out of professional basketball has been disproven by the success of tennis, which is that women's basketball will never draw the crowds because they can't dunk and because they aren't as good as the men and they'll always be compared to the men. But when you look at women's tennis now, it is a different game. The top women cannot compete on an equal basis with the top men, and yet they do draw crowds. It is a very exciting game to watch. In fact, some people prefer watching women's tennis.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mariah Burton Nelson. She's an athlete and sports journalist and author of the new book, Are We Winning Yet? How Women Are Changing Sports and Sports Are Changing Women. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Athlete and sports journalist Mariah Burton Nelson is my guest. So you gave up basketball because of knee injuries, right?
Well, that was part of it. Also, the sexism and homophobia of the league was very difficult for me to handle. So it was a combination of factors. The league folded shortly after I left. It was a very disappointing experience overall, which is why I'm not thrilled when they talk about starting up another pro league, again, with all male owners and all male coaches, and putting the women in skin-tight unitards, which is what they're planning to do, to again sort of feminize and sexualize the women.
Were you out when you were playing in the league?
Well, I was generally out, but when I had a conversation with one of my coaches in which he told me that our uniforms were made by faggots, I thought, well, this is not a man to come out to. So I was not open with him, nor was I open with my teammates, but I did go to Gay Pride Day in San Francisco, where I was playing at the time with 200,000 other people in, as I said, the late 70s or early 80s, and I was spotted there by a news reporter from a television station who had earlier interviewed me, and he told the coach, and that did lead to my being traded.
So you mean this reporter basically outed you?
Yes.
Did you ever talk to the reporter about it?
No, I didn't. You know, it was a funny sort of thing. I thought I saw him. Our eyes met, and I sort of saw my career flash before my eyes, knowing how homophobic my coach was. And yet I thought, well, what are my choices? Can I call this guy up tonight after the parade and say, even though I feel proud and happy and open enough to show up at the parade or the march, I would like you not to tell somebody I was there? You know, it was too much of a contradiction. So I didn't talk to him, but I did hear later that was, in fact, why I was traded. I was told I was traded because I wasn't tall enough and there was nobody taller than me on the whole team.
So. I just want to clarify, did this reporter call your coach just to tell your coach that you were there, or did the reporter mention your name in an article that the coach read?
He did not print it. He directly told the coach. The papers at the time wanted to pick it up, and I asked them not to because I still was interested in playing professional basketball here in the United States after playing for a year in Europe. So I wanted to be picked up by other teams and knew that I would be essentially blacklisted if I were openly gay, although, of course, there are gay women throughout sports, as there are gay men throughout sports. But it's being openly gay that really gives the owners a hard time.
Is this an issue that kept coming up with many of the women who you've interviewed over the years about sports?
Yes, it is. And what was interesting to me in writing Are We Winning Yet? Was that even the straight women brought it up. Jackie Joyner-Kersee told me that she has been called a lesbian, even though she's married.
It's just a cover.
well, yeah, I think not in her case, but perhaps so in some cases. There are extremes that women will go to show that they're not gay because it is such a scary label and, in fact, can have a very deleterious effect on one's career. But what she said was, it's something they do to keep women out of sports. That's all it is. And I think she's right. You know, they used to say that it would damage our uterus if we played sports and we wouldn't be able to have babies. And then we pointed out that we don't need jock straps. We are actually much better protected biologically from sports injuries. And then they said that we didn't have the endurance to run a marathon or to do the distances. And then we sort of waved at the men as we passed them in the marathon. So we've disproven all the other excuses to keep women out of sports. And this is one that still has some power. You know, your daughter will turn gay somehow if she plays sports. People are still afraid of it.
I think athletes are always worried that when they retire from professional sports that their bodies are going to change a lot. Did that happen to you?
It did happen. I had deliberately gained about 20 pounds. I'm naturally thin, and I gained weight in order to be a big, strong center. As a center in basketball, you have to stand your ground, you have to push people around, you have to not let them push you. And it was muscle mass, and I was very proud of my big thighs that were like tree trunks. I naturally lost that weight, and though being thin is generally revered in this culture, it took me a while to get used to being thinner and not being so muscle-bound. I don't parade myself in quite the same way, trying to show off my strength. So in that way, it's been a good thing.
I want to ask you about some of the common frustrations of women athletes that you've interviewed. I think one that really keeps coming up in reading your book is that a lot of sponsors want to make sure that women look attractive. How does this affect women athletes?
One of the women I talked with was Paula Newby Fraser, who has won the Ironman triathlon 3 times. That's that grueling, long triple race in Hawaii where first you swim 2.2 miles in the ocean, and then you ride 110 miles on a bike, and then you run a full 26-mile marathon. And she told me that even while she's running and swimming and biking that long distance, it takes about 9 hours, she is concerned about what she looks like. It's not a judged sport like gymnastics or skating where you're actually judged on what you look like. All that matters is when you cross the finish line. And yet because she's a woman, she receives pressure from her sponsors to do her hair a certain way, to wear a bikini rather than a one-piece suit. She says even among the women, there's a certain sort of meta competition in which the women compete with each other to be as thin as possible.
The pieces that are collected in your new book, Are We Winning Yet?, are mostly profiles of women athletes. And it's mostly women involved in non-team sports?
Yes.
Are you interested at all in covering, you know, like the big-ticket sports, men's professional basketball, football, baseball, that kind of stuff?
No, I don't do that kind of writing as a sports writer. I focus on women and on co-ed sports. I think there's plenty of attention going to football. I don't need to add my voice on that subject. I'm more interested in who women are and how women are changing the nature of sport and the opportunities women are getting these days. But yes, a lot of the sports in the book are co-ed sports because you can't talk about women athletes anymore without talking about men as well. So many of our coaches are male. Husbands and brothers and fathers are putting in their 2 cents, sometimes to our detriment and sometimes in a very helpful way. So it became a book about how women are competing now that we've moved out of the segregated women's gym and into the larger domain of sport.
Well, Mariah, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's good to be here.
My guest has been Mariah Burton Nelson. She's an athlete and sports journalist and author of the new book, Are We Winning Yet? How Women Are Changing Sports and Sports Are Changing Women. This is Fresh Air.